Good morning. Okay. One must turn off cell phones. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Mesa City Council study session for Thursday, September 4th, 2008. And we will begin. Well, first of all, I'd like to begin by yesterday we had a fairly significant announcement, and I would just like to, as if we didn't have an adequate chance yesterday, to thank all the members of staff who are here and who have participated in that process and made that come to pass. We're not 100% there yet, so I don't want to celebrate prematurely, but there's been a lot of work and a lot of very complicated process, and I'd like to congratulate and thank those members of staff and in the city that have participated and been a big part of that. So we'll go on now to reviewing the agenda for next Monday's council meeting, the September 8th council meeting. Page one. Oh, first of all, I apologize. We need to excuse Vice Mayor Jones. Did he have a chance to call in on phone? Okay. Vice Mayor Jones, I believe, is in transit to, is representing the city at a public safety, National League of Cities Public Safety Committee, in which he serves, so he'll be excused. I think he was going to try to call in, but apparently his plans don't allow that, so we'll excuse him this morning. Page two. Page three. Page four. Page five, page six, page seven. Mr. Wesley. Oh, Councilmember Summers, and then Mr. Wesley.
I had to break up the monotony. This thing was going way too well. Item 6B. John, is that what you're hoping to talk about?
It's going to be
6C. Oh, good, because I highlighted that one too. Item 6B, I wonder if we could have somebody define for me the difference between an RV park and an RV subdivision. One of the reasons this is coming forward to council is there was an RV subdivision in my district that was looking to improve the housing stock by placing, better housing on the site. What was interesting in that particular case is that I believe it was a Harvey subdivision that had already had the ability to sell their lots individually. So it wasn't necessarily one owner. It could be individually owned. And we're looking to how do we improve the quality of the housing stock on these facilities. So I'm wondering, is the difference between an RV subdivision, the ability to own individual lots, and an RV park as a single owner?
Yes. That's exactly the difference. The idea basically is that there's one ownership for an RV. I'm sorry, Mayor Smith, Councilmember Summers. An RV park basically is one ownership. They lease spaces out at the individuals. There's not individual designated property ownerships. There are no property lines within the actual park itself. It's just one large ownership, and they place the different units there based on the utility infrastructure that's already there. An RV subdivision, there's actually a recorded plat. The plat gives ownership rights, fee title rights to the people who own those sites. They're relatively small. They're a little bit larger than an RV park space would be. But it gives the ability for people who have RVs to come back to the same spot year after year.
So in order to, why don't you briefly clarify, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to allow, in an RV park or subdivision, where we're trying to allow folks to, instead of doing an RV or an RV with a lean-to, basically, which is the extended Arizona room type of deal, we're trying to allow pre-built housing stock to come onto these sites. Is that correct?
That's correct. An RV, by definition, the RVs are regulated by the Office of Manufactured Building for the state of Arizona. They're to a certain extent, their definition is outside the control of the city. By definition, they're limited to 400 square feet. And in an RV area, the idea is that you can play, and there's something called a park model, which is different than a Winnebago or a Airstream or those types of trailers that you might put behind your car and take with you. The conventional idea of what an RV is. And park models have, since 1988, become very predominant in many of these RV parks and RV subdivisions. The limitation...
A park model is what you see as you drive past, as I can envision, that really looks like a manufactured home, but it's much smaller. It sort of looks like a junior version of a manufactured home.
By definition, it's limited to between 320 and 400 square feet.
So, you know, as you drive by an RV park, you can notice those, or at least it seems like I notice them, because they don't look like an RV, but they're not as big as what would be a normal, what you'd expect from a normal.
And yet people still pay vehicle taxes on those, even though they look like a manufactured home.
Okay.
But by definition, they're limited to 400 square feet. And because they're not part of the building code, you don't put building additions onto them. They're not physically attached to them. So you get this amalgamation of living space that doesn't really flow very well. By placing a manufactured home on the property, you're taking the 400 square feet that you would have for the park model, the 400 square feet that you'd have for your addition, and then the 120 square feet that you would have for your storage room. You add those things together, basically, and you're able to get a much more free-form type of building that can be much more efficient in terms of utilization of space, generally get a higher quality constructed building as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, aesthetically, they're much nicer as well. And
A manufacturer.
As I recall, there are safety issues with them, too. They have to meet a certain standard, whereas trailers do not.
The manufactured home would meet a housing and urban development or a HUD building code requirement. The RV or park model doesn't have a building code, but by convention, the industry uses the American National Standards Institute standards when they construct.
Voluntarily.
Those. Right.
Yeah. There's a few issues I wanted to raise on this, and the reason I bring up the park versus the subdivision is when I first began looking at this, about 6-7 months ago, there was a question on one or two particular sites in the district who were along the freeway but didn't have freeway access. And they were already subdivided, and they had the ability to sell the individual lots. And the idea was, how do we create a community there that has a higher level, a higher standard than what would be if the owner just outright sold the lots to the trailers that don't meet those safety standards. But I also think there's a difference, and maybe worthy of discussion, as to how far we want to go, at least with this ordinance at this point. Do we want to limit it to the subdivisions where lots can be individually sold at this point, or are already individually sold, or do we also want to extend that to the entire RV park, where right now we have one owner? There are a lot of, well, I won't say a lot, I wish we had the map, but there are a few RV parks along Main Street that may be in the future subject to a really solid urban renewal and reuse projects. And the question is, do we want to wait and see what happens with those? Now, I'm not talking about bouncing people out of their homes. We're talking about seasonal RV resorts that people come and go. A second issue is, how are we going to address on some of these locations the question of fire protection? There are some very narrow roads in here. There are few fire hydrants, if any, in some of these facilities. And when we change from mobile RV units to actual housing stock without the upgrade in roads or fire hydrants, that's a recipe for disaster. And I know we have a couple of chief fire officers in the audience who are right now wishing that I hadn't seen them. I don't know if it's necessary to bring one up, but let's do it anyway. and I'm just curious as how we might address that.
Mr. Sheffield.
Mayor Smith, Councilmember Summers, a couple of things to take into account. The way the ordinance is designed, it's the only people who are eligible to apply for a special use permit are those RV parks or RV subdivisions that are in excess of 10 acres. So the sites that are smaller than that would not be eligible for this particular special use permit. Second, it is a special use permit process. It's not a by right condition. So there's still a process involved. And as part of the definition for special use permits, the Board of Adjustment has specific abilities to attach conditions to that special use permit that can address some of the concerns that the fire department or the police department or folks like that might have in terms of upgrading the park. If there are specific things that are clearly life safety issues that need to be addressed as part of that upgrade, then we can take care of that as a condition through the Board of Adjustment. And and when the application comes in, we would certainly farm out copies of those applications to those departments that need to take a look at that and invite their comments so that we understand what conditions need to be applied.
Ms. Sheffield, would this special use permit be a council action item, or would this could be an administrative function?
It would go through either a zoning administrator hearing officer or go to the Board of Adjustment.
And that would be the end there unless someone wanted to appeal it? Or
correct. The appeal would go to Superior Court.
Okay, so that would be the end. So we're not going to be bogged down at the council level with individual, what I would consider more of an administrative action. When you're looking at technical issues such as fire, I don't know that I'm really that would be that thrilled about this body getting involved in technical issues and becoming an administrative body rather than a policymaking body. So,
Mayor, from our standpoint, it's a policy question, and once you've established the policy, then it's our job to administer that policy the best way we can.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments on this issue?
Well, you got some exercise anyway.
Okay. Item 6C, Mr. Wesley. Oh.
No, Councilmember Summers, want to go ahead and say anything about that first or not? But this is a request for freeway landmark signs along 202 and the future 802. The applicant requested two signs initially, and the reason I wanted to mention this, we do have it off consent, just so we have a chance to mention that the recommendation from the Planning and Zoning Board is for only one of those two signs, the one that's right along the 202, and delaying any action for the one that's on would be adjacent to the 802, which is not there yet. And so just want to make sure that was clear in the board action that it would be for the one and not two.
Councilmember Richens.
Speaking of not there yet, I don't think there's a development there yet either. And so, I mean, when we started reviewing these on the design review board level, there was a real large group of us that were uncomfortable with putting freeway landmark signs before developments were. And then they also wanted to see the architecture of the sign match the architecture of the center and make sure that everything tied together. I have a struggle allowing a permit to go forward for a development that has not been constructed yet or hasn't even pulled, I don't even think they've pulled permits to build it yet. I'd like to see those two things happen either simultaneously, but the signs, do we require some kind of bond if the development ever gets built that they have the ability, if they go belly up, do we have the ability to take the sign back down? I mean, what's, help me
Mayor,
understand
Councilman
that.
And, John, are these are signs though that are not necessarily related, I mean, I know the structure is related to development, but the advertising could be related to offsite. Is that correct, or are this related to
Mayor,
offsite?
Councilmembers, signs are related to the adjacent development.
Okay.
So it's not for off-premise advertising.
Okay. Well, what we have, this appears to be a timing issue. We're wanting to approve the concept, not only concept, but the placement of a sign for a development which does not yet exist, which we don't even know exists or will exist. And we're asking for that second sign, or the applicant is asking for that second sign. So really, we're talking about primarily a timing issue here.
Yes, Mayor, that's correct. The applicant has stated to us and to the Planning and Zoning Board that they believe it helps them in their marketing of the site. So they're going looking for tenants. They can say they've already gotten approval for a sign, and you can pick your location that will be on the sign. It helps them to sell the property. But it has been, as Councilmember Richens pointed out, a concern, particularly for the DR Board, in being able to look at the design when they don't have a building that it's supposed to be related to, in order for them to make their recommendation for the sign as is required. The way we've handled that in this case is there's a requirement that before they can actually get that permit for the sign is they have to go back to the DR board so it can be reviewed in conjunction with.
So we would be asked to approve the concept that there will be a sign there, but as far as the actual sign, it's got to go through the normal processes if they're starting from scratch, other than the fact that the concept or the idea that a sign will exist has been approved.
Mayor, that's correct. It goes just a little bit further than that because we're starting to establish the parameters in terms of the
right.
height and the area.
Those are
of the
general
sign.
Parameters, though.
So it starts to lock the board in a little bit on their design prior to having something.
The design or the size and
the size and overall size and area
and general
of the sign
placement
start to lock in that design. And so the board, the design review board, is still a little bit concerned about that. They had another one on their agenda last night.
Now, aren't those standards, though, general? I mean, we have height standards and things like that apply to freeway signs. So aren't those, by their nature, sort of predefined and then applied on an individual basis as to how they conform, that the individual sign design conforms to the general standards?
Mayor, the way the height is set, or by the guidelines, is that they do a balloon test. And the height of the sign is governed by the height needed to be able to see the destination name before you get to that off-ramp. And we've typically given more than is really required for that. The council's been pretty consistent in that. But there's not a set sign height in the code.
Okay. Councilmember Richens?
Do we have the ability to approve the location of the sign but not necessarily the height and everything until it comes back through the process?
As far as that condition that's existing in place, does that conform, or would that allow us to do that?
Just say, okay, we'll allow you the one sign for now at the existing freeway, and then come back through, or I don't know how we do the one on the 802, but they certainly shouldn't be able to build it until there's a freeway there. It's a freeway landmark sign, after all. A freeway is kind of the operative word there.
Councilmember Summers?
If I may address Dave directly, Dave, the freeway is there. The 202 is there. The freeway.
No, I understand that.
And you know that. But the what's not there is the Williams Gateway Freeway, which may take 15 years before that's 10.
We'll ask Dennis when he gets up here later.
Three.
Yeah.
And while there are a lot of unknowns, I mean, we're talking about a sign that's 75 feet in height. It's not small, but it's not huge either. And I think that 75 feet kind of creates a balance between the fact that there is a freeway there right now. We know that there's a new freeway coming. We don't know quite exactly how that's going to impact the height. I think if we were to reduce it to 50 feet.
Well, I didn't say anything about reducing size. I'm just, all I said was.
Well, even going to DRB and design, which I agree with, this should be contingent upon a site plan review in DRB. And I think we could stip that. My concern about with the height is that the freeway isn't going to be there until well after construction of this sign.
Well, I think we're getting a little bit off the path there. As I understand it, so I can restate, what I understand is that what has been approved is the concept that there would be a freeway sign allowed there. If I understand you correctly, Mr. Wesley, the specific design of that is not what's up here because we're not giving approval to actually build the sign. Because there already is a condition in the approval that states if you are going to build a sign, you must come back and go through the process as it relates to specific design and permitting. Therefore, we're only truly acting on the concept that there will be a sign approved in that location consistent with our general standards. We're not approving a specific sign. Is that accurate? Or
yes, Mayor, with the understanding that, in the applicant's mind anyway, you're approving the height of the sign and the area of the sign.
Because that's a general standard.
Yeah.
And that's included in there, the height and that. But the specific design is not, nor are we saying you can put it here or there or whatever, and that would be subject to review as it comes back through the specific permitting process.
Mayor, it is approval for the specific location.
Okay.
The Warner.
Again, they requested two.
Okay.
And the P&Z board has recommended approval of just one. They requested the two.
Right, the specific location on the 80, okay, and on the and on right. the 80.
And so the one okay. up here is the one the P&Z board has recommended approval of, but not down here.
Okay. Councilmember Richens?
Just to be clear, so if we vote for 6C, we're approving two signs.
No.
One on the 202. No, well, if you read it,
I'm sorry. The way you're describing it, yes, you're correct.
So if we vote for 6C as is, we're approving two signs, and that gives the ability to build both signs even before there's a freeway there.
Correct. And that's why Mr. Wesley's brought that up to council. In order for you to take the recommendation of both planning and zoning and DRB, who are only recommending one, you would have to make that motion different than what is already stated in the Gotcha. Okay. In the agenda. So we wanted to make that clear so you didn't go into something and with two signs. So really, I think where I maybe sense where the council is, or to be consistent with PNZ and DRB, you would recommend the one sign. The location appears to be near the Warner Road 202 loop, as that generally described. And the height will be determined by the balloon test, essentially. Is that the best, what's the best way to say that?
Or
has that already been determined?
Right, Mayor.
Oh, 75, that's right.
Right, it's already been standard, already set.
Well, it's already been set, but that was determined by...
It was determined.
Because there is, John, at this point, the freeway is still elevated, I believe, at that point. So that maybe much drives a lot of that height issues. But as far as the design...
It will go back to the design.
Look, that will go back at the time that they're ready to move forward.
When there's a building to prepare.
One more quick question.
No, go right ahead.
That's okay. If we approve the one sign, will the location be kind of set up to where they can get that second sign when the freeway goes, the 802 goes in? Because I know that there's a distance requirement between.
If I understand you correctly, council member, what we're worried about is that there would be a sign in the middle of nowhere that we're approving that, you know, there's not a freeway, there's not, but there's this huge sign sitting out there that somehow we are approving. Conceptually, and from the previous votes of this council, we don't disagree with freeway signs, and we've agreed that those are okay within the standards we've talked about. What you're asking about is this one specific sign, and the fear that somehow we may have a sign in the middle of nowhere before a freeway without adequate further review.
Very well restated.
Well, I just now to get back to the procedural matter, what we have here does not follow that because what the PNZ and the design review have recommended approval of the one sign with the second sign not being approved. And so for us to act on this, if we approve this, we are going against the recommendation of PNZ and DRB.
Mayor, as the agenda is currently written, yes, and it was based on the application submitted. If council wants to give direction on what type of ordinance you want to introduce, for example, only the one sign at the 202 and the Warner, we can draft the agenda language, which will allow it to go on the consent agenda with that in mind.
Okay.
Or we can do a separate motion on Monday.
Councilmember Summers.
And that would be my recommendation, is that we look at the PNZ and DRB recommendation, and we draft an introduction.
Consistent with that. Do we have any problems among the council members with that? Councilmember Fenter.
I do.
Okay.
I would hope that we could somehow get him, or get this property owner, and I've had no contact with him, to the concept that yes, you're allowed two signs when everything goes in, you sell and package your property like that, but not inhibit him or her or whoever it is to allow him to get to that point. So we want to be business friendly. We want him to say, yeah, we realize someday something's going to be there. But have them come back and say, hey, we won't do that second sign until 801's there.
Let me ask you something. Is what is approved, because I think this does come to a policy level, could they build that first sign right now before a project? Or do they, you know, which is the chicken, which is the egg? Because it seems to me if we're approving the first sign, do we really want, as a policy, to allow people to build what would be, in essence, a marketing sign that's 75 feet high? Or do we want the sign to advertise the actual development that's built?
Mayor, the STIPs that are currently in the case require that before they can get the permit for that sign, they have to have site plan approved and actual building elevations so that the design review board can then relook at this sign and approve it. So we're at least getting that close before a sign permit could be issued.
But they technically, but they based on that, they point, could build a 75-foot sign without a building being on site.
They could.
I would add, Mayor, in response to that, I think this is being big business friendly. We are stepping out a little bit in advance. As Dave noted, we don't have a site plan on here yet. We have no idea who the tenants are going to be yet. So we are trying to be flexible. I also was thinking about the two signs, and while I'm not adverse to the idea of having two signs given the freeway, it's very premature for that second sign because that freeway isn't there yet. So we're not pretty sure where that alignment's going to be, but we need to have some latitude. The other issue is, too, is when you think about some developments that are larger, the Superstition Springs Mall has one sign. The mall in Dennis's district, Fiesta, I almost forgot, Fiesta District has one sign. Riverview, I think, has two or three, and they kept, or five, And they kept coming back for one because it's every time they got a new sign, it was because they put in a new developer. I think they got an extra sign because of the Toby Keith and one for Bass Pro. And those were kind of marquee venues at that. So
you make a good point because the development was there already, and so it was able to reflect what was happening at the development.
Sheffield, did you have something to add?
To clarify a question that came up a little bit earlier, in order for them to get a permit for a sign, they have to have an occupancy on the property or a building permit for an occupancy.
Okay.
So they would not be allowed to build a detached sign unless they were actually issued a construction permit for a building. So they couldn't build a sign for a vacant property.
All right. So the sign, there has to be a building because there has to be an occupancy.
Correct.
For the sign to. Okay. That's good to know.
No, I knew that. But the difference being with some of the, I mean, their occupancies already in both Fiesta and Superstition Springs Mall, again, we have one sign. The reason for the one property that has more is auto dealers and a couple of marquee tenants, so we were allowing more signs there. It's
sure.
Still,
yeah, no,
I think we can be business.
I'm just trying to address the issue of building the freeway sign for vacant land.
Yeah. But I do appreciate that.
Okay, no, and once again, I think the issue on the table right now is not whether we're going to allow signs or this, it's whether we are willing to go ahead and allow two signs with a formal approval now, and one being by a freeway which exists, the other one being by a freeway which does not exist, or whether we're going to follow the recommendation of the P&Z and design review, which is to approve one with conditions on the second. Is that
correct, Mayor? John, can I ask a question? The second sign that's being proposed, based on the anticipated alignment that we know today, would it be adjacent to that? Because it looks like it may not necessarily be a property that it would abut the frontage of the freeway, or am I mistaken on that?
Mayor, Councilmember, City Manager, it's right where the two freeways would. It's turned the other way. I can't see it. It's right where the two freeways would come together. So it's
okay,
maybe
so
difficult to say
okay.
For sure, but it is a little further south, more along where the 802 starts.
Okay. And well, let's get back to the item on issue right now. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Wesley.
One last comment with that. As stated earlier, we judge how high that sign is supposed to be based on the elevation of the freeway and that balloon test. There's no freeway there yet to judge the balloon test with. That was another concern that staff had about approving that sign now. We really don't know how high it should be.
As an agenda item, let's get back to the issue. The issue is, are we going to act upon the application as submitted, taking into account the P&Z and Design Review Board, and that would be an up or down type of a thing, or do we want to go back and give directions to rewrite or basically resubmit or tell the applicant resubmit or write an ordinance which conforms with the recommendations of the P&Z and the DRB? I mean, really, that's the issue we're dealing with right now.
Right, Mayor, and if you go for option number two, so that you want to accept the P&Z recommendation, we don't have to go back and ask the applicant to resubmit. We can just present that ordinance for introduction on Monday.
Okay, so as far as our action on Monday, what's the sense of the council? Would you like to take it, and this will be an up or down, or we're basically adding a sort of a stipulation by rewriting the ordinance. We're accepting the conditions that have been presented by P&Z and DRB. What's the sense? Councilmember Richardson and Councilmember Summers.
I'm for approving the one sign, and tell the applicant, hey, when the freeway's there, come on in. We'll
okay,
get
so
sign.
You would agree with the P&Z
simple.
And the DRB.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
Councilmember Summers.
I would second that if it were a motion.
Councilmember Fenter.
I would support, you know, I put great value on P&Z and DRB, although I would almost recommend they go back and try and work out a compromise so we could meet everything, but I'll stay with the recommendations.
And I believe that this has been discussed with the applicant because I know that I think they've mentioned it to me, Mr. Wesley, and I think they're comfortable with the action that the P&Z and DRB.
So.
That's what I've been communicating. Okay, so we're okay with that. Then rewriting the ordinance is going to be introduced. And we can debate the whole concept of freeway signs and placement, I think, at a later time. But as far as this goes, we're going to follow. We're going to go back and rewrite that ordinance. Okay? All right.
That should get it on consent at that point.
That should get it on consent.
If that's the direction of the council, you'd like us to do that.
I think
that as long as we do that, because once again, we're following their recommendations. So, yeah, Councilmember Summers.
Will we be able to do that so it's on consent agenda for this agenda?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll proceed.
Okay, item 6C now.
Mayor, actually, I wanted to slide back up to 6B. I wanted to
Oh, I'm sorry, this was 6C. You want to slide back to 6B?
I hate to do that to you, but I realized we had moved on before I had asked. I had questions on whether, for council, is if they would consider perhaps moving forward with this amendment, but only including at this point RV subdivisions, which are, again, are individually owned lots as opposed to RV parks. I'm just curious in what the temperature of council is, or maybe any, need a little time to review it, that maybe we should continue this for 2 weeks, and so we all have time to look at it a little bit.
Any input, questions? I'm not sure I've had an adequate enough discussion on this to really make that decision right now.
Mayor, can I recommend that we make a 2-week continuance?
Would we have any problems with continuing this for a couple of weeks? I'm sorry?
It's just an introduction.
Oh, is this just introduction?
This is just the introduction.
Well, if we introduce it with RV park and RV subdivision, I guess the question to our attorney is then would we be locked into that, or when it comes down to a final approval, could we change it that week?
You could not change it then. So we can either move forward and then at action either approve as introduced, or we would have to go back and reintroduce.
Okay, so then in that way it would probably behoove us, if we want to consider that point, to continue for 2 weeks the introduction, then I'll go back to that.
Let's do that, and if staff can get us just a tad bit more information so we understand, or we can at least digest the information that's been given to us so we can understand the difference between the park and the subdivision.
So continue till the 22nd?
Yes.
Yeah, just 2 weeks.
Okay. Any other items on page 7? Page 8? Page 9? And page 10. Okay. Item number 2, hear a presentation and discuss MAG regional planning activities. Mr. Smith, Mr. Anderson, welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. Good morning, Mayor and Council. Just wanted to introduce Dennis Smith, the Executive Director of MAG, and Eric Anderson, the Transportation Director at MAG, and also give a little disclaimer, too. The city manager had seen a presentation that Dennis had presented to the City Managers Association a few months ago and thought this would be a really good perspective for Council to see. And you'll see a lot of transportation discussion in this, which I think is really important. We'd actually asked Dennis to come before the courts had ruled on the time coalition and ruling that off the ballot for this November. So we hope that actually this will provide an opportunity over at least the next couple of years before the next opportunity for voters to approve or view some kind of transportation initiative, that we can actually fine-tune it, make it even better for the residents of Maricopa County and the residents of Mesa. So with that, Mayor, I'll just turn it over to Dennis and Eric.
Thank you, Mayor Smith, members of the council, for the invitation to be here today. We're kind of at a very interesting point in growth and transportation policy in Arizona, and I don't know what that means about my presentation, but I don't know what the significance of that is. But today we're here to talk about regional perspective. Cities have tremendous challenges, especially in these economic times, and the region has great challenges that we would like to talk about today. So here's kind of what we're going to go through today. What are councils of governments and metropolitan planning organizations known as COGS and MPOs? We're going to talk a little bit about growth projections, transportation issues and concerns, and then our future challenges. So just briefly, councils of governments, I'd like to start by saying Mesa's charter member of the Maricopa Association of Governments, formed in 1967. MAG would not be here without the outstanding leadership that has been provided over the years by the city of Mesa, whether it's on the regional council, chairing policy committees, chairing technical committees. You know, Mesa has always stepped up when it came to talking about the region, especially in the freeway program. They've just been solidly behind this regional freeway program. So as a council of governments, it's not just transportation. We have a regional domestic violence programs. We have homelessness programs. We have the 911 committees, actually chaired by Chief Beck from Mesa. So we can do a number of things, but really what the focus, if you look at our budget is principally driven from federal and state revenues for transportation. So in 1973, the federal government initiated this concept called Metropolitan Planning Organizations. And to be honest with you, in 1973, there wasn't a lot for these organizations to do. But as time has evolved in the early 90s with changes in federal transportation law, with the interstate system being completed, much more authority was given to Metropolitan Planning Organizations. Actually, we're an MPO and a TMA, a Transportation Management Area. That means we're over 200,000 in population, designated by the Secretary of Transportation, and we have much more decision-making authority when it comes to transportation projects. There are six councils of governments in Arizona. The entire state is split up into councils of governments, and there are five metropolitan planning organizations. So why does transportation matter? You know, we put this slide in. You know, I've actually been at MAG since I guess we don't even want to go back that far, but a long time. Anyway, I've been here for this 25-year period talked about on this slide, and we have worked diligently on this freeway program. And it was interesting when the Business Journal asked all of the legends in the valley, what was the most significant business story? Look at what was number one, buildup of the freeway infrastructure. It beat Palo Verde. It beat the Groundwater Act. We don't have to tell citizens in places like Mesa, it's the lifeblood of your economy. These freeways, we were just talking about signs. Those signs are important because your major developments are right next to this freeway corridors. Look down to Tucson. They don't have the freeway corridors. We have them. That's because local elected officials who run the Maricopa Association of Governments made a decision in 1985 to go for a tax to build that freeway system. It was the mayors that stepped up and got that done with the business community. It was initiated out of MAG. Before we go too much further, I just want to, if there's only one point I want to leave with you here today, you are the Maricopa Association of Governments. It's not Eric, it's not me, we're just the staff. You know, you control it, you make the decisions. If we do a great job, it's because of you. If we're doing not so great a job, it's because of us. So I think that's the way it works, isn't it, Chris? So anyway, working regionally, right at the top of this slide, it's governance, not government. It's all in the title. We're the Association of Governments. It's a plural. Government, regional government, is Maricopa County. They have regulatory authority. They can tax you. They can do bonding. We can't do any of that. So this is all about governance. It's all about cities working collaboratively to do significant regional programs. This is the local voice in planning. That unit of government closest to the people needs to be in charge of regional planning. That's what we believe in our organization, so we're trying to drive decisions down to the local level. That's what the federal law was all about when it changed in the early 90s. It said, well, if we're going to extend the federal gas tax, where's the action at? Well, the action's in the metro areas. Who's closest to the people? Who hears a noise complaint? It's the mayor or the council member. So that was the whole concept of why we're trying to drive this down to the local level. This is a map that our staff put together. These are not official projections. This is our best shot at where the growth was going to go in Arizona. We developed this slide, did a poster on it actually, gave it to the legislature. And when they actually saw it graphically, they said, look at all the population and we don't have any roads. And this ended up in the first stand legislation of over $300 million coming to the cities throughout the state. So in 2005, 6 million, 2050, 16 million. Now that could be 2050, that could be 2060, but you get the idea that we're a rapidly growing state, either first or second in the nation, and infrastructure is lagging behind. And then this is just a chart that shows you throughout the state how the different counties are going to grow, and we're going to go on the next slide and show you kind of graphically where that happens. So these are the growth areas, and obviously the darker colors, the more growth. The next slide, which areas are growing faster? You're starting to see a theme here. The theme is right where we're living. And where are the densities the highest? Right in what's now being called the megapolitan area. So even though we're growing a lot, our staff member, and I would like to give credit to Bob Hazlett, a very talented engineer who did a lot of this slideshow and did the research and spent 4 or 5 months going around the state talking to all of the different stakeholders. But before he did that, he said, well, how are we getting pressured from outside of our state? And you can see here in these bar charts where the significant growth, look at the growth in California, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico. Arizona's in a squeeze play on growth. Not only are we growing greatly, the whole Intermountain region, and then we're greatly influenced by California. This gives you an idea of our border populations and how fast they're growing. So we're even getting pressured from the south, from Mexico. To give you an idea on this, plus 10 million from the southern part of California, Nevada, Las Vegas, 220% growth. And you're all thinking right now, well, it's slowed up now, and it's probably not going to be, maybe not, but you know, when I came here in 1976, I said this place is not going to keep growing the way it is. It's going to slow down. Eric was here before that. None of us believe that this growth is really going to slow up. We're just in one of those cycles, and then Arizona is going to take off again. Utah, look at the growth, 470% growth on our northern border, and New Mexico, 150% growth. And so our engineer who put this together walked around the state, and you can see here that in Mexico, obviously because they're close to our borders, that's the fastest growing part of Mexico, and we have some real transportation issues coming into the state. And then in New Mexico, they're really taking advantage of their I-25, and they're putting their high-tech corridor in over there. And so what they're doing, we've become a land bridge between California and New Mexico. And in Utah, some of the fastest growing parts of Utah are the northern part, and they're impacting the northern part of our state. And Nevada, you look at there up at the left, it says out of land, and they have water issues, they have land issues, but they are a huge community. It's either one or number two. We're always the rival with Vegas on who's growing faster. And when you look at that, we're going to get into some slides here in a little bit. In 1991, they said the freeway system had been completed, and so let's go on to other issues in transportation. So you have the fastest or the second fastest growing parts of the United States, and guess where there's no freeway? Here to Vegas. So I think when you're discussing federal issues with Scott, who's going to be working those for you, you might want to think about that when we're going back to Congress. What are some of the federal priorities that might emerge? And then we talked a little bit about California, 60 million by 2050. So we've always been tied to California. We're tied especially to Long Beach and freight, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the future. Then we went in, and our engineer who did this report went throughout the state and said, well, what's going to happen within Arizona? Well, we have the copper mining, which is huge, beating up the roads in eastern Arizona. You have a lot of growth, extreme growth in Mojave County. You have truckers going and taking alternate routes to avoid elevation issues in Arizona, and they're going up through the Prescott area. The line there you see on the left, they're going up routes in the western part of Arizona. And the population that you're most interested in here in Mesa and going into Pinal County is going to double. So now let's talk a little bit more about that. Now we're going to go into the transportation part of it. So this map came out of some of the research that we do to prepare our transportation model. So we know the volumes that are current volumes in this area. So you can see in there 303,000 vehicles per day on I-10 West, 294,000 on the Broadway Curve, which many of you probably go through every day, 225,000 on Dunlap, and on and on. Let's look at the next slide. So here's really what would happen if the freeways were wide enough. And up until this reconnaissance study that we did in cooperation with all those other regional planning agencies, there really wasn't even a statewide transportation modeling tool to tell you the projections of traffic. So here we are, the fastest growing state in the nation, and we don't have the tool. So we developed what's called a sketch modeling tool to at least give us an idea of the volume. So if you could build it wide enough, and that's the big if, 750,000 on I-10 west of State Route 51, 660,000, imagine that on the Broadway curve. You cannot build the Broadway curve that wide. That's the whole point of this slide. We can't build them wide enough. So we have to come up with alternatives for how we're going to move people in the area. And that the ideal solution is that everyone would work and live in the same place. Well, anyone that's married knows that's not the reality. One is usually traveling quite a bit, and the other one is living and working closer to home. This will give you an idea visually of the issue. So blue is good. That means you have a lot of capacity, and red is bad. So when you see the red overtaking the blue, you know you have a problem. This is the heart attack map, as we discussed. This is really where the future of Arizona is, and why the Time Initiative was interested in addressing it. We do need to attack this problem, but later in the presentation, we're going to discuss some of the other issues we need to address here. When we did this travel demand modeling tool, even though it was a sketch modeling tool, you know, there was some real ahas in here, and we all know and we hear so much about Phoenix to Tucson, that's the big travel demand corridor. Well, look at the Phoenix to Central Yavapai. And that's why, if you read the newspaper, people are always talking about Interstate 17. They're saying, we don't need to talk about future projections. It doesn't work today. So we have some very significant transportation issues that need to be addressed here. And obviously, you name it, any part of the state, you could put a line on the map, another road, another freeway, another parkway needs to be developed. So what did we learn out of that reconnaissance study? Well, we have an opportunity to shape how we're going to grow. Arizona is still rapidly growing. There's a lot of vacant land, and we could change the way we grow. Obviously, we need an increased investment, or we're not going to be globally competitive. If you don't have a great transportation infrastructure, you're not globally competitive. We need to maintain what we have. That's an issue that ADOT reminds us of all the time. You know, let's not talk always about the future. Let's maintain what we have. We need a permanent funding source, and we need to collaboratively plan for transportation and land use in Arizona. So here we are. We're sitting here in 2008. So what have we learned from the past? Well, here was the population in 55, 470,000, and the population in 2000, 3.1 million. Now let's go forward, and I'm cautioning you, these are projections, and you're going to see some of these numbers change between 2040 and 2050 and 2060. But you can get an idea of how the valley is going to grow here in the 6.9 million that's going to happen in 2040. So what happened back in 1960? How did we get this regional freeway program that we really enjoy out in the East Valley, Santan, Red Mountain, Superstition? It really came about with some engineers from City of Phoenix, Federal Highway Department, ADOT, sat down, probably back in the days of slide rules, no computers, no travel demand models. And they sat down with Wilbur Smith Consulting, and they came up with this highway plan. Today, we would call it fancier names like a vision or something like that, but it was a highway plan developed by engineers. So when I was working at MAG and in 1984, when we started doing the Southeast Valley study, we were still looking back at this study, because this study laid out miraculously almost the freeway program that we have now. There are some changes. We've lost some corridors. We've moved some out. But this was the vision. And what we tell people is when you look into the future, you need to go back in the past, because these people hit our population projections very close for the period that they were looking at. And those freeways actually happen. So we're doing modern-day Wilbur Smith plans now. We're calling them framework studies. We're trying to get in front of growth. And we're trying to make sure that we have preserved in these plans some of the jewels of Arizona, why people moved here in the first place. I can tell you my personal story. I came down from Montana in 1976, and I can still remember that Sunset Magazine article, and it was talking about the Japanese gardens and the canal banks in Phoenix, and that how cool that was, and you could go down the bank and enjoy all that. It's all gone. If we don't do responsible planning in the future, we're going to see a lot of these jewels that you came here for disappearing, and I think it really is going to impact our quality of life. So these framework studies are trying to address not only infrastructure, but some of the things that we really need to preserve. This is an example of a framework study. This is in the West Valley. This is west of the White Tank Mountains. It's called the Haciampa Study. And you can see there the population in 2005, 138,000, build out 2.8 million. There are so many developments out there, you would not believe it. We were actually almost pushed into this study because Federal Highway Administration said, we're not going to put more interchanges on Interstate 10 because you're killing Interstate 10. And there needs to be a system plan. And so our office, Bob Hazlett, the engineer, went out on this study, contributed to by the cities and ADOT and the county, worked with the development community, came up with a way to sort out all of these highways and roads. Actually, Buckeye adopted all of it in their general plan. So I think the message here is you don't need regulatory control to do good planning. If you go out cooperatively, I think, Eric, there was, what, 100 and some meetings for this with the landowners, and there was consensus, and it all ended up being approved. Here is another one. Now, this one you can start to see is going to impact Mesa. You can see the Gila River Indian community here, which is between us and Pinal County, but you can see where the growth is going. It's going south out of Mesa, and it's going around the Western Valley into Pinal County. This was another joint study with the DOT, Pinal County, and the neighboring cities. One of the points of this, a lot of great freeways, parkways, transit alternatives, there's really no money for this. So at some point, for Arizona to continue to grow, we're going to need to come up with a funding strategy. Now what you're interested in out here, the beautiful Superstition Vistas. I know the mayor's personally involved in this, and it's such a beautiful place out there. So here we are, 275,000 square miles.
275. Not thousand.
Just 275 square miles. There's a difference there. 900,000 people, that's the high side. 270,000 is the low side. So let's just see what happens. Let's just see how big that is. Hopefully this will work. Look at that. It's almost the entire East Valley. Some of the old-timers here might remember the Golden Corridor that this used to be called. Now it's called the Sun Corridor. This is the next big challenge beyond our regional transportation plan that we need to be looking at. This represents 35% of the state land area and 86% of the population. So I know that there are great people out in Greenlee County and Navajo County and other places, but when you really think, where do we really need to put a lot of focus in Arizona? It's right in this corridor. Now, it could be Maricopa, Pinal, and Pima. That's one way to look at it. Others have added Yavapai. Others have added Santa Cruz and Cochise. Megapolitans, this is a national nomenclature now, and at one time there were 10 of them, and we were one. Now I've seen another report where there's approximately 20. But what it's really getting at is the economic engine of the United States is in very few places. And there needs to be an emphasis on these areas in order to compete in the global economy. I just wanted to let you know that we haven't missed this point. This is an example of the modeling area that we are doing for transportation between us, Pima Association of Governments, and Pinal County. We are all tied together. We're working together. We're modeling the area. If we were not modeling in Pinal County, our transportation projections would not work for Mesa. Matter of fact, that was the case about 10 years ago. Your engineers were coming in to us and say, what do you mean level of service is good in Mesa? Why isn't that a red dot? I drive it every day. Well, when we extended this modeling network down into Pinal County, guess what? Your level of service turned red, because then our model was really capturing what it needed to capture. This is an idea of some of the joint studies. One of the first studies that we did into Pinal County was actually the one involving the Southeast Valley. So it was the Southeast Valley, Maricopa, Northern Pinal County study area. Out of that came many freeway corridors. This is the Hidden Valley study that we talked about a little earlier. So what are some of our challenges? Well, I like to look at the megapolitan area and say, let's dive in there and let's all of us make a plan for that. And that's very challenging and very interesting. But we made a promise in 2004 to the voters of Maricopa County when we went out and asked for a tax. And we said, here's the ART Regional Transportation Plan, and we're going to deliver it. Well, right now, the incredible challenge that cities and our regions facing is the economy. And we're going to need to go back into our regional freeway system plan, and we're going to need to keep it balanced. You may be asking, well, why do you need to do that? What's the requirement? It's a state law. It's called a life cycle program. Costs and revenues need to be balanced. Mayor Smith, serving on our Transportation Policy Committee, that's going to be the big challenge in the next few months. How do you bring this program back in balance when you have costs still going up, unbelievably still going up, and you know what the revenue situation is? So we have to put that program back in balance. The other real challenge we have, we're doing a system study for transit. And we launched that, and then the gas prices, everybody saw what's going on with the gas prices. You know all the express buses are standing room only. I think when we get this transit framework study done, and then we're looking back at our existing regional transportation plan, people are going to start saying, well, were those assumptions that you made when you put the plan to bed in September of 2003, are those still valid, or should we be doing something different? If the answer is the latter, and you want to make a severe change, you're going to need to go back to the voters, because we made a promise on that plan. This is going to take a lot of work at the Maricopa Association of Governments. Your staff's going to be very busy in this. Another challenge we have is the decennial census. We've done the special census since 1975, 85, 95. We hired 5,000 people to count everybody in the valley, and we also work collaboratively on the decennial. So you have the occupancy rates declining with vacant homes, with the foreclosures, and we're going to have a real challenge in counting the immigrant population. So this is going to be very interesting. This should be a high priority in any city, to be working with MAG and the other cities to get the best population count. Your state shared revenue counts on it. So this should be a real priority in any city. And then competing in the global economy and need to keep up with our peer regions. It's interesting, if you go to Denver or Las Vegas or Salt Lake, and some of these places aren't larger than we are, but in some ways, you know, they're ahead of us. And we need to take the blinders off and look at what our competitors are doing, and we need to work together regionally to address these challenges. There's a report out from California. They're talking about their economic strategy, and that's what's going to drive it, whether you need transportation improvements, water delivery improvements. So they're looking at it from an economic perspective, not just an infrastructure perspective, and I think that's another missing piece in Arizona. That's the end of the presentation. Eric, you might want to, there were some comments on Gateway Freeway earlier, and you might want to address that.
Yeah, the Williams Gateway Freeway right now is scheduled to start construction in 2016. One of the issues that we'll be dealing with is what happens, because we've seen a tremendous run-up in construction costs. In fact, from the time we approved the regional transportation plan in late 2003 through today, construction costs nationally for road and highway construction have gone up 77% versus the more typical consumer price index, which has gone up 18 or 19%. So we're faced with major cost challenges. Then our revenues, for the first time since we've had a transportation tax, last fiscal year, 08, we actually had a decline in revenues. And then our first month of revenues for this fiscal year, our July revenues, were down 11.5%, which is a record. We've never had that kind of decline. So the pain that cities are facing in terms of their revenues certainly are impacting our transportation tax, too. So, face of lower revenues and higher costs, we have some real challenges ahead. We know that Williams Gateway is an important facility, especially to serve the Phoenix Gateway Airport. But I think as a region, we're all going to have to come together and deal with our fiscal issues right now.
I also think we need to keep an eye on what's going on globally. You know, I have an article here from Los Angeles Times. They're issuing a proposal for the Deepwater Port down in the Baja. They expect to have the proposals in next summer, and they expect to have a port, a $4 billion port, in 2014. What does that mean to Arizona and this region? With the UP line that's coming out of the West Valley going to Yuma, it's not even active right now. What does it mean to this megapolitan area? I think we need to think strategically about where we're at in the global economy. Freight is so backed up at Long Beach, and we know what's happening on Interstate 10. So I think we need to take a big picture view of this.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for Dennis or Eric? I don't know whether that's an exciting report or a sobering report. It's a little bit of both. I think one thing, and I don't know how you balance this, because what happens is that I believe the world is changing and has changed, and I think that our way of thinking with $4 a gallon gas, the reality that is probably a permanent situation rather than just a blip. I think a lot of that we need to take into account how that will affect our growth, and not only growth in general, because I think we'll continue to grow simply because this is a great place to live, but where people choose to grow and where they choose to live, I should say, and how it's going to affect us economically. I think the whole model has been shaken, and as we look at, for example, our gateway, I've heard some criticisms that you're feeding into urban sprawl, and I think they miss the point as to the purpose of gateway, which is to be the anti-sprawl. The idea is that gateway will become a hub, a center, so that people in Queen Creek, Gateway, Gilbert, Pinal, and East Mesa will now have a hub to go into, and I think that's the future. That's where our growth will take place. And as we establish these hubs of job centers and whatever, that's where we're going. That's going to change our transportation. The question is whether we can keep up with that and change and balance decisions that are made. And you mentioned promises made to voters. Voters approved a plan. And certainly that's the plan they approved, and that's why we respect that plan. As we go forward, we're going to have to balance the changes in what we have to deal with what voters approved and what expectations are. And I see that as one of our greatest challenges, is that the world is changing. We may or may not be a freeway-driven economy 10, 15 years from now. I don't know, but I know that there are alternatives and options that I don't believe we've taken really seriously in this valley. Is that a double freeway driven? I guess there's no other way to do that, is it? Okay. So that's going to be the challenge, is to really be not only be creative, but to try and get ahead rather than continually playing catch up. Which, because of economics, what you're saying is, I don't know how we get even caught up or ahead of that, because we're already behind the eight ball as far as certainly I-17 and those places go. So thank you so very much. Appreciate it. I'm sure this is the first of many a discussion and presentation, so we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis.
Okay, item three, hear presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan.
Mayor and Council, while we're getting the PowerPoint pulled up, I think that was a great foundation for the discussion of this particular area of Mesa. As you just pointed out, we're looking at a plan for the southeast portion of Mesa around the Mesa, the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport area, and it is an opportunity to do something new and different to be that anti-sprawl, that new urban center of employment for that area of the city. We are before you this morning with a revised vision, goals, and objectives for this plan, and we're looking for your tentative approval of those this morning. We say tentative because we'll actually package the whole document back together as we've finished all the pieces, and we'll come back for final approval later. So there could be some minor tweaks as we go forward, but this certainly sets the foundation for the rest of this planning process. Might, before I go too much further, to get started, to point out Mike and Mark here with me, been part of this planning team, been working on this. And
Mike and Mark, that Mike sounds like some, good, some good, sort good, of morning radio team. Hey, guys, how you doing?
But been very much part of this process and here to help answer any questions. You recall that back on June 26th, we were before the joint meeting of the council and P&Z board to get feedback on the draft plan as it existed at that time. Direction from the group was that we simplify the plan and we go back and gain greater consensus of the basic big picture items, the basic vision and goals for the area before we move forward with some of the details. So we've been working on that, and that's what we have back for you this morning. We've made some minor adjustments to the vision. We've consolidated the goals that we had before and reworked the objectives and created some general design guidelines to go with those. So this vision statement came out of October Policy Advisory Committee meeting and some other stakeholders that were involved in giving us some feedback and direction in this area. We have, again, tweaked this just slightly from what you've seen before in the second sentence, primarily emphasizing the place that we're trying to create in this area. Then the next level of plan for this area is to develop the goals that we're trying to accomplish. We've been talking about these goals throughout this planning process. The previous plan had a list of five goals, again, that came out of that visioning process in October. As we continue to work on the plan over the course of the next couple of months and worked up to the decision theater, we kind of crafted some slightly different things we were calling goals also. And so we've taken each of those and consolidated them into this list of five goals. First one emphasizing the airport. Certainly it is the key to the area, and we want to see the airport grow and mature and become all that it can be for not only Mesa, but for the Southeast Valley and the larger metropolitan area, and it's very important that we do so. So that's that first goal. All along, we've talked about this area as being a region for jobs, of high-quality jobs, and we've set this goal of creating at least 100,000 high-wage, high-value jobs in this area by 2030. Infrastructure, as we just heard, is a very important key to making all this work, and we heard about the Aerotropolis concept earlier, too, and that those connections locally and to the larger region are very important. So that's one of the key goals. Sustainability. We need to create a region that is physically sustainable, that is environmentally sustainable, and those things. And that's been a model, or it's been a key that's come out of the early vision process, that idea of sustainability. And then we need to plan for implementation of the area. So we've got goals dealing with each of those items. And if, I guess I'd stop at this point and see. These goals are a basis for the rest of the plan. Are there any particular comments anybody would have on the goals? Have we captured the right goals? Is there anything that you see is missing from there?
Councilmember Summers?
John, I was going to wait one more slide, but I'll speak to this. We're talking about goal number one says expanding the airport. And the second bullet, if you want to switch to that slide, too, protecting primary flight corridors. I think it's important to note that typically when we're thinking about the flight corridors, we're thinking about the MD-80s and the larger aircraft and how they take off. And we did a very comprehensive study of those noise contours thanks to ASU Decision Theater. But those flight corridors also include the smaller aircraft and, very importantly, too, Boeing still utilizes this with some of their test aircraft. So oftentimes you'll see Boeing will come in here and discuss what their flight patterns are, what their needs are, ingress and egress from the site, because they plan to utilize Gateway for the long term. So when we consider protecting primary flight corridors, we have to consider not just airplanes, but also the rotor wing as well.
Absolutely.
Councilmember Richards.
With these goals, are the ideas that any development proposals that come forward would reference a goal saying this helps us accomplish goal 1A kind of thing? So yeah. I want to know what's the mechanism that's going to tie these goals to anything that happens out there?
Okay, sure. Good question. Mayor, Councilmember Richards, yes, that is the plan. In fact, as we go on with this presentation and get to that next level, we're going to take these general goals, objectives, and guidelines for the entire area and bring them down to some sub-areas within the overall planning area. We've got 32 square miles. It's a large area. There's some differences in how we expect some of the areas to develop. So we're going to refine them just a little bit more down to those levels. But then as each individual development comes in, the idea is that we can be a little bit more flexible in terms of talking about specific uses and where they may go as long as they can meet the goals. And so these goals, objectives, and measuring any development against them is what we will do in the future. And if it's furthering the goals and objectives, then great, it will move forward. If we see some problems, we'll try to make those adjustments so that it would meet then those goals.
John, as we talk about the flight corridors and protecting airport operations, this is where it gets really sticky because there's wide variety of opinions as to what we can do, what we need to do, what we must do to protect those. Everything from, the easiest way to protect the flight corridors is to do nothing. And I think what we've realized is that, at least what I've believe is that if we do nothing, then we stifle the rest of the overall objective. So we have to somehow find this balance to where we have development that is balanced with airport operations, with the idea if we're going to err on the side of the airport operations, because that is the driver of all the economic success, and we're not going to kill that. So I'll be interested to see as we get down into, for example, protecting primary flight quarters, how we exactly measure that and define that. What's been the thought process so far, and where are we headed as to how we define what it means to protect airport operations? You say flight corridors, and I have some other as far as airport operations, which I believe go beyond flight corridors. We can keep things out of the flight corridors and still mess up the airport if we do other things transportation-wise and infrastructure-wise that have a negative impact on airport operations. So where are you moving as far as that goes?
Mayor, council members, I'd be glad to let the Mark and Mike team over here help you with this response. But
by the way, what's the temperature outside right now?
That's certainly part of taking the framework down to that next level, because we know as we come off to the northwest, where the major flights go that way, into the southeast, that there are more specific things we need to do there, where those major impacts are than they are just kind of northeast of the airport or southwest of the airport. So we'll be able to look at those and provide more specifics in those areas to help describe where those primary corridors are, and remember the helicopters also, and then look at what's needed in terms of construction techniques, what types of uses may or may not be more important or may need certain techniques to go with them to help them be able to be there, and the types of outdoor spaces that go with those so that they're not as impacted by the noise.
Okay.
Well, and Mayor, and I think what we really want to do is lay out a framework with specific objectives that we don't necessarily in detail regulate, but we provide it as a performance standard for development to suggest to us, tell us how you're going to make sure that whatever development you are proposing. And obviously, we'll have certain areas where this is more relevant as it relates to protecting the airport or ensuring that the airport can continue to be successful. So let them bring to us ideas about whether it's related to sound or noise, or whether it's related to height or whatever it might be. Let them, I think part of the challenge is, too, we want them to be able to bring that to us.
I would even go one step further. I'm not sure that I want to let them. I think the burden should be on development.
Yeah.
And I have no problem placing them, personally, placing the burden on development to say, now, here's how our development will affect airport operations, which includes flight zones, which includes infrastructure, which includes use, which may or may not affect the airport operation. Now, that means we need to come up with some objective standards that every applicant can walk in and say, here's your packet, here's what you're, when you come back in, here's what you're going to have to present to us to show. I think a lot of this can be self-regulating in the sense that we establish a standard and some objective goals and that they will meet, and it will be up to them to show to us how they affect airport operations. And I think a lot of things will just, by their nature, sort of self-regulate in the sense that you're not going to meet the three, and so we need to move on to something else. I don't want to get in the, and I think one of the big dangers is getting in the mode that every little parcel that comes in comes before this body, and we're having another debate on whether it, how it affects flight operations. I think we've really missed the boat if we do that. And I don't think that should be our role. I think we should define the overall objectives like we're doing right now and then provide that framework, as Mr. Brady said, and then put the burden on the landowner to say, here, that's part of our framework of providing flexibility. Well, with flexibility comes great responsibility in my mind. And as long as we provide that, then that will become more of an administrative process where we can really concentrate at this level on the overall plan and the overall objectives. Councilmember Summers.
I will object to only one of the issues that you mentioned, Mayor, and that is the best way to protect an airport or this airport is to not develop anything around it. I think that actually hurts the airport more than bad development. If we want to balance that creating 100,000 jobs, if we want to grow this airport, then we have to bring businesses and jobs to it. And the way we be flexible is looking at flight paths and operations, say these are great locations for offices, for Fortune 500 companies, for industries, for R&D technology-based industries to move in. Just outside of that, if we want to do mixed use, high density urban like what you see on the north side of Tempe, that works there. And so it just depends on how these are utilized, but being flexible, allowing development to show how they're going to complement that airport operation, how they're going to meet goal number two of creating 100,000 high wage jobs. We have, I'm going to hold DMB up again. Right now, their projections and the type of jobs they're creating, the number of jobs, is about half of that 100,000. That 100,000, if everybody does what DMB's doing or projecting, will exceed that 100,000 job mark easily. But they're putting together, when we're going to talk about planned community district, that a district that has that mix of uses, high-wage jobs, office spaces, Fortune 500 company, and yes, some residential, and works beautifully with the airport.
And I would say that we're not really far off. The comment I was making is that, and I have had many presentations to me, where the proposal to protect flight paths is do nothing, build nothing underneath them. That's the ultimate way to protect flight paths. That is counterproductive to ensuring that the airport exists and ensuring that the airport thrives. There is a balance we're going to have to maintain, and the reality is the market will drive us to where I've never been comfortable. I understand the need to throw out numbers for goals. I've never been comfortable with 100,000. I think 100,000 is a product rather than an objective. I think if we do things right, I agree with Councilmember Summers, I think we'll far exceed the number of jobs we think. I don't feel comfortable with saying we want 100,000 jobs. I would rather have us say we want this area to reach its full potential. And its full potential, maybe 75,000 high paying, maybe 175,000. I think if we do our job right and maintain that balance and create this framework, that the market will take it to where it goes, which I believe is much higher than what we think it is. So,
okay.
Thank getting you. Back to where you're going. Go ahead.
So with those goals, we have in your packet then a list of objectives that go with each of those goals, which bring those goals down to slightly more specific things we feel like we need to accomplish in order to implement the goal. And then along with those, some general design, general development guidelines to be used as individual development projects come in, part of that starting to establish those standards that, that developers understand they would need to meet in order to accomplish the goal and implement the vision for the area. So what we have for you this, on the screen is just kind of a summary of those objectives and guidelines. You have the full list in your packets. But with the goal to capitalize on the airport, we have objectives that talk about expanding the airport, protecting those flight corridors, and general development guidelines that encourage design that does not affect flight operations, the provision of navigation easements, and then one, you know, this is common to each one of them, design objective for meeting those more specific district guidelines as they're developed. Second goal, again, is creating the 100,000 high-wage, high-value jobs. We had some discussion about this along the lines of what the mayor mentioned a minute ago. There are those who are concerned this is not a high enough, aggressive enough goal, some who feel like it should be a little bit more general. There's been some concern that we are maybe ignoring some of the other uses that might need to come out, develop out there that support those high-value jobs. So the objectives have tried to speak to that, the need to have a variety of jobs overall, need to target some of the specific businesses that are mentioned in the overall plan, and the development of urban cores and mixed-use developments so we have that style of development that is appropriate for the area and works well with those high-value jobs. Then the general development guidelines, high-quality design standards in urban densities, mixing of uses, taking advantage of that freeway frontage with the types of development that occur, and again, the district guidelines. The goal for establishing interconnected multimodal transportation system. Again, when we learned about the Aerotropolis concept, one of the key points there was access in order to develop this type of community. It's both access immediately around the airport and then access to the larger region. So these objectives speak to coordinating the land use with the transportation system, providing multiple transportation options and coordinating with our regional partners in the area to make sure that all the systems work together, get people into and out of the region as well as around within it. And then the general development guidelines encouraging the connectivity and densities that support transit, the use of the complete streets concept that's in there that balances both the pedestrians and the vehicles and other modes of transportation in that street area. Fourth goal, become a model of sustainable development practices. Objectives speak to the timing of development with infrastructure, balancing of land uses, recruiting businesses involved in sustainability, and establishing sustainable development criteria and development guidelines, evaluating development based on impact on infrastructure, and evaluating based on environmental impacts, minimizing vehicle trips, and again, area-specific guidelines. The fifth goal.
Councilmember Richens has a question.
Quick question. Sustainability is really broadly defined. Sometimes we struggled through that in our retreat recently too. What standards do you base these concepts on? Because they can be really broad and broadly interpreted. So, has there been any thought to that yet, or this is probably still pretty preliminary? But what are your thoughts there,
Mayor, Councilmember Richens? This has been mostly related to the fiscal and financial sustainability, although there's some aspects of environmental sustainability within it, but we haven't gotten too much more specific than that.
Is the plan to get more specific as we flesh these things out? So I'm trying to make a connection between sustainability as a goal and then how do we do it in from a policy standpoint down the road, so when a development proposal comes in and I look at it, I can say, oh, this is a sustainable development or this is not.
Again, the plan at this point has been related mostly to that timing of infrastructure and development so that it occurs and that the development's occurring in a way that helps pay for that infrastructure and the ongoing maintenance in the area. There's been some discussion, and this part we're still fleshing out probably a little bit more, in terms of the types of industries and businesses that we attract. We have some opportunity, we think, to be a model of sustainable development in that way, too, bring in industries that are involved in green building, sustainable type development, and then certainly try to develop the design guidelines and so forth if they take advantage of environmental issues with that design.
And sustainable, I agree that sustainability doesn't only apply to the environmental issues, but there are building standards out there that exist nationally that I think we can look to, and perhaps it would be important to reference them, like the LEED standard, just kind of the standard right now. But it may be important to reference that kind of thing, so we have a benchmark of some kind of what sustainability is. And then when people come in to build sustainable development, they'll understand what we're talking about as well.
Well, I think we also have an opportunity here. It used to be not too long ago that thinking of things such as LEED standards, it was almost an aberration. Now I think it's becoming more of the norm and acceptable and even advantageous for people to build it. I think with this type of area, once again, I'm constantly reminded that the gateway planning area is the size of the city of Tempe. We have the opportunity, I think, to establish a standard. We not only want Gateway to create jobs, we want it to establish a standard that is recognized throughout the nation, if not the world. And I think part of the standards is that opportunity we have to set these standards is perhaps in sustainability that goes beyond. And I understand you've only taken it so far, but maybe we need to perhaps look at ways that we can create incentives, create flexibility that rewards those developers that use sustainable approaches to building, to development, to those types of things, and maybe look to raise our objectives in the gateway area to create this kind of model community, the model development 21st century as it relates to environmental sustainability also.
And Mayor, I think in council, maybe what we could do, I think those are all very helpful conversations we need to hear from the council, because obviously there's some large opportunities coming to you today that you're going to hear about that we need to talk about. And maybe what we needed to go back and kind of set aside too is thinking about what are the overall goals of sustainability we want to achieve. Is it, you know, a certain reduction in certain types of uses of water or power or whatever it might be? So maybe that's something we as staff can do, is start kind of looking at what are kind of the expected types of goals and objectives that can be accomplished in the broader sense of what we're trying to achieve. Because the techniques we all know, whether it's solar power, whether it's, you know, using LEED for building standards, those we want to achieve ultimately something in the long term is sustainability, is reduction in the, you know, the carbon footprint, whatever it might be. Maybe we could come back and at least set up some goals of what we want to try to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think that would be good. I can look at something, for example, as simple as our landscape standards. You know, we have citywide landscapes that encourage water conservation. Well, you know, perhaps we can go back and think of some new way to maintain high quality of landscaping, but maybe use this as almost a test area to say, let's try and develop some more specific, and I just use landscaping because it's an example where we could literally look at our existing standards. But you know, once again, the easiest way to save water on landscaping is to don't plant plants. That's easy. Yeah, we have. But that doesn't accomplish what we want. We want the gateway area to be special, and that means that we want plants, we want greenery, but we also want to devise new ways to have people, when they come in with a landscape plan, to make sustainability and water there's a common goal there. We want you to maximize your landscape and your green to perhaps the carbon footprint or the heat island or whatever. That could be one of the things, but we also want you to limit water. That's a challenge that we can take on as a staff, and we have that opportunity because we have a clean palette here in this right. area.
And it's not just about the other environmental aspects either. This is how you attract the creative class.
Yeah, I think,
you attract,
and that's what we progressed
to. Business. They're into that now. And
yeah, 5 years ago, and that's what I meant. 5 years ago, they weren't into that. Now, there is a connectivity between economic achievement and sustainability that didn't exist 5 years ago. So we can use this. We can really make this a standard. That's great. Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. The last goal is plan for implementation. We have some objectives there that speak to working with our regional partners, developing some funding mechanisms, encouraging legislative changes to facilitate implementation, and utilizing form-based approach to zoning and development to help encourage the type of development in the form we want to occur in the area. So those are the goals, objectives, and design guidelines for the area. Next steps. Based on council direction today, we will go back to the planning document. And you recall we had this large area approach first. We've had this framework, again, where we divided the whole area into some smaller areas. we'll be reworking that and then the design manual that goes with that because it's more design-based approach. When we've got those ready, and we've been working on them a little bit already, we'll take those back to the Policy Advisory Committee and Stakeholder Advisory Committee for their input. We're planning on a joint meeting again between this body and the Planning and Zoning Board in October to then review that level of the plan, get agreement on that piece. Then staff will go back with the consultant, put the whole plan back together, and bring that back through that same similar process for review and approval. We'll include a public open house as part of that review also, and then hoping to get back to council for final action in early December. And just real quick, we have been working on that framework, just to show you where we are on that. When you saw this before, it had six or seven areas. We've narrowed them down to four areas now because of the kind of more expanded role they're going to take.
Could you give a little bit, add to that, because you went from six or seven down to four. A little background on that as to that movement.
Okay. Again, this is a large area, and we know that there are differences in how some of these areas will actually develop. That area immediately around the airport to the northeast side will be a lot of uses for the traveling public as they come in and out of the airport and the campus on the west. Those uses and how that we expect that to develop is different than what we see kind of south of the freeway and southeast of the airport, where heavy overflight impact and more industrial type uses will occur. In that area to the northeast of the airport, where we're going to be talking about here in a minute, the GM property, you know, we expect that's the area where we really can get that most complete community type development to occur with great integration of residential and employment and retail uses. And so that's going to be a little bit different than that one in the northwest, where maybe we can't have quite as much integration of use. So we think it's important to look at each of those areas and give a little bit of refinement of the goals and objectives of how they might apply in that area, so we can then let the developers understand when you bring in a project, here's what we need to see in that area so that it can be a project we can approve.
Great. Thank you.
So with that, I think we've maybe already done this, but any questions or discussion?
Councilmember Summers.
John, that urban mixed-use area to the north of your port, can't stress enough, it's still very touchy, because the modeling we did with the help of the ASU Decision Theater demonstrates currently that there are areas in there where it's in excess of 80 decibel because of the overflights. And as flights increase, we're going to be seeing more of that noise. Now, hopefully, as the MD-80s start to be replaced by the newer, quieter airlines, we can see more of that, some of those residential uses that are Tempe-like, that North Tempe style, the heavily insulated, possibly in some areas. But again, we got to be really careful. I mean, that urban mixed-use area is going to be the point of contention, and the very difficult decisions will be in that area, specifically because of the overflights, and that's where we have to be really cautious in our land use decisions.
Councilmember Fenter.
Later, I'd like to get with staff. I've had some feedback and some concerns on goal number two on that 100,000 jobs. How's that implemented? How does it affect free market? And how would we implement? And so I'd like to get some feedback maybe from economic development and you and a real clear way of how we're going to accomplish that.
Okay. And, you know, to expand on that, because I've had some people act like that too, or I have some people who have raised that concern. I think one of our big challenges that we haven't addressed here that we're going to have to deal with is the vision 30 years from now versus what we do in years 1 through 29. And as part of our framework, I believe we need to create a mechanism in which or through which this area can grow organically, because we're going to have changes in land use that get us to the ultimate goal. Literally, the construction yard of today will be the Class A office space in 25 years. You know, and that's the reality. And I don't believe that it's either prudent or it's right for us to say, well, since we want an office building 30 years from now, you can't do anything right now. But on the other hand, we can't say, well, gee, we're going to hope that you realize that in 28 years this will be an office building, because you know, there's that balance once again. Somehow, through the use of use permits or through other things, we need to be able to lock in an ultimate land use that is actually the highest and best based on the economic potential of this area, while allowing property owners to use their property in the interim. And I don't know exactly what that is, but I'd like to, that needs to be, in my mind, a major focus as to how we grow into what we really want, how we get through adolescence. I guess we're infancy too, but really how we do that and allow this area to grow while not basically messing up the overall objective and the overall plan. And that to me is a big challenge that we have. I spent some time with one of the land users there and tried to explain this concept, and it was, Mr. Rigby was there with me, it was very difficult to explain to the land user. We're trying to tell them, no, we want to help you by giving you more flexibility, and the general feeling is, no, we come in, we get a zoning category we want, and it's locked in, and it's there in perpetuity. And I don't think that's the reality of this area, that that's how it's going to work, because I think if we lock things in perpetuity, we will create the kind of conflicts that we're trying to avoid. So somehow we need to come up with that legal mechanism and that approach mechanism where we can show people that we want to give you both the flexibility to grow into the natural, final, and best use, which we think it's going to be, and also allow you your private property rights, which is to use your property.
And Mayor, right. I think the 100,000 is a number that I know has been out there for some time. I think the message here, though, is from an economic development perspective is right now Mesa is far behind as far as the number of jobs per household.
Right.
And so our goal here is that this is to be, and we could even maybe restate it as something, this will be the regional employment center, for this area or something like that. The idea that this needs, the focus has to be on job creation. Ultimately, what that number might be, as you suggest, is going to be really dictated by the market. But we also want to be able to use it, though, as a goal and objective so that when developers do come in, and if they're building large structures that only have one person per, half acre, something that really dilutes it, that may not necessarily be warehousing. That may not necessarily want where we want to be in the long term. And you're right, Mayor, we understand there is going to be an evolutionary phase of development out there. But your next item on the study session is the beginning of that dialogue. It is not something the council is going to be talking about a year from now. It begins today with development that's coming through. Is how do we allow for that to market evolution to begin early on, but ultimately allow it and put in place today the elements that will encourage ultimately the 30-year vision where that, storage yard becomes, a significant employment
center. And I understand how that works within the context of a planned community district where you have a single owner and a single plan. But we're talking about the PCD as being, 5-6 square miles in a 30-plus square mile area. And I think our greatest challenge is not going to be in the PCD. It's applying those concepts and that approach to a mishmash of 40-acre parcels and 60-acre parcels that are currently existing under an approved general plan that we are now trying to bring. We have hard zoning, we have vested land rights, we have non-zoned land, or at least maybe zoned ag that will be transitioned, that are underlie an existing general plan, and then we have this conceptual plan. And I think our greatest challenge is going to be how to balance that and try, not dictate, we cannot and should not dictate, but basically create a framework where we guide all the property or as much as we can to that ultimate use.
Right.
I mean, we have got to figure out a way to get somebody who has industrial zoned land that sits smack dab in what our 30-year vision is, an urban center, and try and get them to say, okay, we understand you have, or maybe it's just general planned industrial because of a previous general plan. We've changed our way of thinking in many areas. So how do we get the person to recognize that that the upside potential is within this urban core designation? We understand that you have the rights right now to use it for industrial use. Let's find a balance that will help that transition.
Right.
So where we reach our ultimate goal.
And Mayor, I think you're heading in the right direction. Is if we can build into
the way we plan and regulate with flexibility and bring a lot more of that to the development side for the benefit of the property owner and the ultimate developer, with the kind of the benefit back to the city is how do we then achieve that qualitative and beating our objectives in the long term. And so it's that balance of can we get more flexibility for them to even respond to the market. And as opposed, sometimes, you know, developers really do get locked into that zoning and realize that it's so difficult to change it. And even though the market may suggest something else, it makes it difficult to respond. So we can come with a very responsive ability.
Well, I think the biggest challenge we and those who follow us will have is trying to balance this overall long-term vision with individual zoning cases. Yeah. And I think we'll lose the war if we fight it with small 20-acre battles. Because when you get down to that level of detail, you lose the vision. Because now you're talking about, is this industrial or is it commercial? And that now becomes your battle. And you lose the overall context of really what we want to accomplish. And that gets back to what Councilmember Summers was talking about, that in that, for example, that certain area, if we're getting down to 10-acre parcel and 20-acre parcels, it's real easy to lose the overall context. On the other hand, you can't go in and do a blanket and says this is what will be across the board, because that's not reality, because you do have individual zoned parcels. There's a legal mechanism and a planning mechanism that we need to come up with that will try to balance that out. And that's going to be tough. That's going to be a real challenge. Councilmember Richens.
I think you can take some notes from other industrial areas around the country. Dallas has some interesting ones. Even Phoenix has some interesting industrial areas that are starting to transform into arts districts and converting factories into condos and that kind of thing. So maybe it's more driven by architectural style and the building forms and shapes and not necessarily by the, I mean, we're all locked into the Euclidean zoning where it has to be it's use-driven instead of form-driven. And I really think that's why it's so important that we're looking at the forms of what's being built here, because it changes everything. It's not as land-use focused. It's more, you know, what do these things look like, and then what can they become in the future? And nationwide, you have these old industrial areas that are transformed into hip, cool places that the creative class like to come and locate, and I think that's possible here.
I would agree with you, and I think that we've stated that we want to move toward that more form. Our reality comes back that we have a lot of Euclidean zoning in place, and the question is how do we transform that, and how do we have those two work together? That's a big challenge. Do you have a comment, Councilman Summers?
I think there are better examples of how development has happened around airports. You got to remember that this isn't entirely a reuse. It is in one extent, but it's farmland. It's a GM proving ground. It's a whole lot of dirt. There are no very few warehouses or anything out there. So we're really starting from scratch, building around an airport, and thankfully we have one very large property owned by a very experienced developer who I think the center of gravity is going to be around that. And so when it comes to the smaller property owners, I think they're going to realize just such a large benefit from what's going on the former GM property, that they're going to find that their land values have gone up tremendously, and the opportunities to use their land are going to go up tremendously. So when you look at areas like airports in Southern California, I'm blanking right now. John Wayne. What was the one in Texas we were talking about? You were from Texas.
Lovefield. Alliance?
Was it Alliance Airport? I think it was Alliance Airport, yeah. And how those developed out, because those developed out very much from scratch as well. We may have a lot of issues with the smaller and how to balance those smaller property owners. I think a lot of those might be inside the loop. But something tells me the fact that this is a lot of dirt, a lot of farmland, and with what that announcement we just had yesterday, we might find this goes a little bit smoother because high-end businesses and those mid-rise high-end office buildings might want to locate here a lot sooner than 30 years, might be more like 5 to 10 as freeways get built and more people start moving in. So there are, in short, I think there are better models to look at. We should look at those as well and how those other communities are in Texas and Southern California, how they dealt with the growth around those airports.
Thank you. Anything else? Mr. Leslie?
Mayor, Council, we were looking for direction this morning to know if the Council is supportive of these goals and objectives as we have drafted at this point so we can go to the next level.
I think with integrating the comments that we have, I have a sense that we're in consensus, that we appreciate the progress that's been made. I mean, I'd like to commend staff. This has been a big shift and a big change, and it's been less than 90 days now since we really made this step, and I think you've done an incredible job of really shifting gears and moving in a direction that we feel comfortable with and I think is the right direction. And you know, that's not an easy process to all of a sudden stop and maybe turn. And you've done a great job so far. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from stakeholders who appreciate the fact that their voices are being heard, and they appreciate the fact that staff has been very open to ideas. And the fact that, for example, that going from 7 to 4, I understand, is based on a lot of the conversations you've had with stakeholders and others who have had an input. So far, the reports that have come back have been very positive, and I'd like to express my appreciation for your willingness to not only change the direction and the way we're thinking to a more progressive and what I think is a more appropriate approach to this, but also to listen to those who truly have a stake in this, and that's everyone. And I think there's a lot of people who felt they didn't, you know, for whatever reason, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but at least now they're feeling that they have their voice and that staff is truly listening and incorporating some of their ideas. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. Mark and Mike, back to traffic.
Traffic light,
and it's 84 degrees out there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Mr. Brady, the next couple presentations, what's the timing on that? You want to take a short little break, or can we get through this pretty quickly? Why don't we take 5 minutes? It's about 20 after, 17 after. Let's come back at 9:25. 7-8 minute break, if that's okay. Let's take about a 6-7 minute break.
You're welcome to if you'd
like. All right, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is item number 4. Hear a presentation and discuss the proposed planned community district for the Mesa Proving Grounds. Once again, Laura, John, Gordon. That doesn't sound like a morning show, does it? It just doesn't have the same ring as Mark and Mike. Oh, that's a, morning latte show on TV. Okay.
I'm sorry, so to say morning latte?
What? Okay.
We have some?
Mayor, council members, with thank that you. Great introduction, we are just briefly going to hit the highlights of the Mesa Proving Grounds DMB community plan that you have been given to review. We know that you've got some other things on your agenda, so we'll come back at future meetings and go into a little bit more detail. So we're going to skip the PowerPoint presentation. I'll be hitting a few of those items as I go through. You've gotten a copy of the book. This is the community plan for the Mesa Proving Grounds. Just real quickly, a year ago, the council approved a planned community district, zoning district for the city of Mesa. DMB has applied for that for their 3,200-acre project. Part of that requires that they develop and get approval through the council of a community plan. That community plan will be the governing document for development on the property. It basically is the zoning, if you were, for the property. And the regulations that are in it are the ones that staff will use to implement development process and review development that occurs in the future. So this plan creates a plan for the property and the implementation tools for how to accomplish that plan. And again, the goal is to get a lot of information up front so there can be a lot more flexibility later on in the processing of the applications. The way this has been designed and proposed for this particular development is once the council approves this community plan, nothing else comes back to council. The development unit plans are approved either by the Planning and Zoning Board.
Well, when you say nothing, unless there is a deviation.
Unless there's an amendment to the community plan itself.
Okay.
Right.
or an amendment. But the development unit plans that's being proposed would be approved by Planning and Zoning Board or staff, and the site plans, same by the Planning and Zoning Board or staff. So it's important that, the council looks closely at the document at this time and is comfortable with the development proposal. The book, the first two chapters of the book are basically introduction, background information. Section 3, that is the vision. That's the plan for the property. So when you look at that and read that, you should feel like you get a good picture of what the intent is for the development. Sections 4, 5, and 6 are the regulatory process, the processes that will be used for approving and modifying the CP, for reviewing the development unit plans in 5, and Section 6 is the site plan process. So those are very key to that long-term development of the property and how those are going to be reviewed. The rest of the document, starting in Section 7, is really primarily what we call the general development standards. Section 7 are what we call LUGs, the land use groups, or the zoning categories, kind of those sub-zoning categories for the property. I want to spend just a minute here with what's on the ELMO. We've got what they call the chassis plan, which shows that overall intent, the vision for the area, which has the two cores, the one in the northwest, the one down by the airport, and then kind of that spine that goes to the middle, and then the various residential and village areas within that. But I want to talk just a minute about what you're looking at when you look at the LUGs. And Gordon can help with any detail on these. We're going from, this proposal is going from the more Euclidean, we talked about this a little bit in the last item, that Euclidean use-based approach to more of a form-based approach that puts the use second. And the way that they have done this utilizes these maps, and I've got two that out of all of them that I thought I'd show quickly. This is for the village land use group. And these are primarily residential areas that can have integrated commercial within them. The map on the top shows that in some of these areas, there would be, you can't use this particular land use group. But with the darker color shows where you're more likely to see this particular land use group in the overall 3,200 acres. Now, the pictures at the bottom of these pages are very important as being kind of the key pictures that give you a guide to understand the character of the type of development that you would expect to see within this particular land use group. So if we contrast that with the urban core designation, you can see that the urban cores are primarily projected along the western portion of the property, possible down to the south, but that's where we'll see the most intense developments, where you see that darkest color, or most likely see those cores develop. Then you can see the pictures on the bottom of this page and contrast those with what you saw in the village. You see much more intense, you see the high rise, you see the office building, as opposed to that more residential in the village.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
Mayor, question I have is, so when a developer comes in and just shows you, I'll just say a normal basic subdivision, you would say it doesn't meet the land use that we have called out. Is that how that would happen?
Potentially. That's what we'll be doing, is all of the standards that are in here from Section 7 on back give us those design standards, as we were kind of talking about with what we want to create in this overall Mesa Gateway area. Any development that comes in, there's a section in Section 6, part of that lays out those criteria that we will use as staff or the P&Z board, and they need to show that their particular development is consistent with those different standards before we'll give it approval.
Okay.
One of the big changes we're making here is that by using a graphical, really a standard, rather than a verbiage, where you and I can read verbiage, first of all, how do you define an architectural standard? It's very difficult. The second thing is that when you read it and I read it and Dave Richens sees something hip and cool, and I may see something dull and boring, and that happens a lot. Whereas if we have a graphical, we can both look at the picture and it's pretty much, it is what it is, and we can compare what they're doing with maybe a graphical interface. So I think that's a huge step in number one, in reality establishing a more well-defined standard, and also giving the type of flexibility we're talking about.
Yes. And so what we will see in this area is they are planning for what we were again talking about before, is for this to be able to evolve over time. They set some standards for how developments can occur and how they address the street primarily, because they're trying to create an urban environment. And while today you might have a parking lot that's right there behind the street, they've designed it in a way so that parking lot in the future can become an office building, or that house can transition to an office, or whatever it might be as it evolves and changes over time.
Because, John, that doesn't necessarily
expectations here, let's manage expectations a little bit. That won't necessarily be the first thing we see coming out in those areas. There are no, as I understand, there's no minimum standards as far as height, or are there? How is that dealt with on that issue? Because the expectations that the only types of development you would see in that area are not necessarily what you're seeing in those photos.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is part of that evolutionary process. There are some very basic minimum standards in the urban core that still allow to do a one-story, but as I believe it says, it needs to have an appearance of a one-and-a-half to two-story structure. But it is being set up so it can evolve over time as that market grows. The part of the plan requires that maximum infrastructure be put in up front. So there is that encouragement and that pressure to continue to evolve and develop to that maximum as things happen in the area.
And that's the essence of form. We're going to make the relationship to the street, the relationship to each other, and whether it's a residence or an office or retail, it basically follows the same form requirements, which are presentation and location, that type of thing. Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, I just had this one question that these words are keep coming up, and I don't know if I don't get always all the difference, but we used Euclidean, we're saying form-based, and then we're saying organic development. And I've had some people ask me, what do all those mean? I'm like, well, I'll ask that question. So can you kind of just get a little definition so
Sir,
people understand what you're talking about?
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, Euclidean comes from a court case in 1926 of City of Euclid, and that's where the Supreme Court approved the concept of zoning, and it is very much use-based. And so you divide your city into use districts, and you have your commercial and your residential and so forth, and that's the key. A form-based code looks at the form of development, the bulk of the buildings, and how they relate to each other as the primary driver for different districts, with the uses that occur within those being secondary. As long as the buildings work well together and you've created that streetscape, it shouldn't matter as much what use is actually occurring in there. And then organic is maybe not as widely used, but it's I think that's dealing more with that evolution over time and things that relate, again, well together and can adjust with each other as those times change.
It may be a good example that I've always used is, for example, as let's say back in the turn of the century, a downtown naturally developed where you would have a street scene which developed naturally, storefronts with houses above, and you may have a retail next to an office next to literally a, what do you call the guy who puts in shoe horses? The
blacksmith.
Thank you. Or something. Those were all standard uses in a downtown. And that would almost be a form, a naturally occurring form typing. We went to Euclidean, and all of a sudden we decided, no, Main Street can only be used for retail stores. You can't live there anymore. And we defined the use as strictly this, strictly that, strictly that. So you know, that's sort of, in many ways, that's very good. And that's what we've really followed, certainly here in Mesa. And in most cities, that's what we followed for the last 50, 60 years, at least. Councilmember Richens?
I just had a quick question. Did I hear you right that you're going to require the infrastructure for whatever the potential highest use is be put in initially, so as the use evolves over time, the need to go back and retrofit infrastructure is not necessary?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, that's what they have put into their community plan that they plan to do. When you read in Section 3, I believe, yes, in Section 3, they make those commitments to doing that.
Thank you.
Okay.
So again, just quickly going through the rest of the document, you get to Section 8, and that's design guidelines and some more development standards in the different sections that come beyond there. We start talking about the street characters and what those are going to look like in this urban form. Again, some differences that you'll see in here, they are proposing narrower streets. More narrower streets is what they talk about. In an urban condition, with that right-of-way being just behind the curb, gives them a lot more flexibility what they can do there in that sidewalk area between the curb and the buildings and how those can be utilized in creating the urban condition that they're after. We can expect maybe traffic in this area, particularly in the most urban areas, to be a little bit more congested than we see in other parts of the city for bigger periods of the day, but it's part of what they are looking to get in creating that street kind of appearance. Throughout the rest of the document, you'll see a lot of pictures. Again, that help describe the types of uses. I think this particular one is parks and plazas that's up there. And so you can look through those as you look through the document. Just a couple other real quick items I want to point out. that maybe aren't the same as the slides that Gordon's putting up because I'm throwing them a curve. But the land use budget is an important element. You'll find that on page 22, section 4, page 22. That tells you about the different land use groups or the development units and the range of development to expect to see in those areas. So you might want to look at that and give you that overall maximum that they're proposing for the area, 15,000 dwelling units and 20 million square feet of non-residential use. And then in section 8, there's a description of each of the different land use districts in terms of just a short paragraph that says District 1 is expected to be this and District 2 is expected to be this. It gives you some idea, because that's part of the key up front is being comfortable that we have an understanding of what the development is supposed to be so that we can then just monitor it later. Are they meeting that goal? So you might want to pay particular attention to that in Section 8. And I think with that, I'll just see if you have any other questions right now that we can answer to help guide you through your review of this. We'll be back, I believe, next week with a little bit more detail. But I want to get you started and looking through this document.
That would be great. Any specific questions?
And Mayor, if I could just invite the council, maybe next week,
come prepared.
Bring your binders, because it would probably be helpful as you're walking through here. Because really, John, this is what the council will see.
Yes.
And I mean, as far as
this plus, Mayor, Council, we have been working since we got this. It's still we've been working very quickly on this document in a compressed set of time. So. DMB provided this for us last week. Has it just been since last week? And so it's the final proposal they had. We've been going through it, finding things that we believe still need to be adjusted to make sure we are comfortable in the language. So we've actually got a red line version of this that you'll get prior to your actual action on it. Planning and Zoning Board is going to be considering it tonight once they have made the recommendation. So you've got this. It's not substantive changes that are going on, but just some of those final adjustments and tweaks to make sure it's working like we want it to. So you'll see that in addition. But you can be reviewing this because it's not much change from this document.
And John, this is the detail the council will be approving.
Yes, as amended through.
Amendments, but form of what you're seeing here. Yes. I just want to make that clear. So.
But as everyone understands, this is it we're approving, and after that, then it becomes an administrative function.
There you go. That's why next week and the weeks after, we may make sure council is comfortable with this.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Appreciate it. All right. Next item on the agenda. Council committees, you want to let's defer that? Yeah. You want to just get done with this and then go in so we don't have to come back to here? Let's just finish up the study session, then we'll just go right into executive, okay? But let's remove 5.
Oh, okay. We'll come back and do that.
Yeah, let's come back at another meeting. Let's just come back and do that another meeting. Okay, reports of meetings, conference attended. Let's skip that. General information and scheduled meetings. Mr. Brady.
Mayor, just there is a time change for next. First of all, remind you that we do have a council meeting Monday. We'll be starting just a little bit early. The council needs to convene as Enterprise Zone Commission. If you recall, we had a presentation on Enterprise Zone. You have to convene as a commission. There's some minor business items that you need to approve at that point. So we'll do that before the council meeting. But for next Thursday, September 11th, I believe the council has been invited to the ASU Poly opening of their new buildings. And so to allow the council to participate in that, I think the mayor's going to be participating in that, as well as then at 10 a.m. here at City Hall Plaza, we'll be having the police and fire departments will be having a 9/11 commemorative ceremony. I believe it starts at 10. So to accommodate, allow the council to participate in both of those events, we will delay the beginning of our study session that day to, I think we're going to post it for 10:30 a.m. and maybe a little bit later than that. And then we'll come back here and have that meeting. We'll try to keep the items fairly brief, but one of those items will continue to go back over this community plan that we just saw, so, and just maybe a few other items that the council will see. So that's just a little bit changed from what we've seen for council study session on Thursday.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you.
Mr. Freeland?
Yes, we have also a Transportation and Infrastructure Committee meeting Monday.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. And that's 3:30?
I believe, is it 3 or 3:30?
3:30, yeah. 3:30. Thank you, Jack.
Okay. Ms. Crocker, are there any requests from citizens present?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay, entertain a motion to adjourn. Moved by Councilmember Richens, second by Councilmember Summers. All in favor?
Aye.
Now I'll entertain a motion to convene an executive session. So moved by Councilmember Higgins, second by Councilmember Fenter. We'll now convene in an executive session.
I say nay.